You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 15th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Tom Philpott of Mother Jones on why he's still skeptical of GMOs. Also on the program today, budget deal continues to be revealed. Of course, why wouldn't we cut money to regulate Wall Street? Relief for the long-term unemployed fails in the Senate. Republicans filibuster two bills. Unbelievable that we've simply let these people just drift away. Also on the program today, TPP having a tough time getting through Democrats in the House and Senate, at least in terms of fast track for the moment. Chris Christie still in hot water, not the least of which, apparently, Bruce no longer likes him.
If he ever did.
If he ever did. Probably not.
Now Chris Christie is really regretting that whole bridge scandal.
Yes. This is the worst thing that could happen to Chris Christie until he goes to prison. And this story from Bloomberg News. This is just a shout out to our libertarian friends who like to call into the funner half of the program, as it were. Bloomberg reports, when the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency declared that a group of Texas homes near a gas drilling operation didn't have dangerous levels of methane in their water, it relied on tests conducted by the driller itself. Wow. And what do you know, folks? It seems that a subsequent test,
surprise, surprise,
from Duke University researchers have found combustible levels of methane in some of the wells, and homeowners justifiably want the EPA to reopen the case. Shelley Perdue, who lives near one of the two wells in Weatherford, Texas, says, I don't understand why they would let the company that was accused of the wrongdoing do the tests. It doesn't make any sense. The driller is known as Range Resources Corp. It denies, of course, that its drilling is responsible for any of the methane that happens to be in these wells. And they say that the tests were conducted by an independent laboratory that they commissioned. The EPA says states have the primary responsibility to keep drinking water safe. It agreed to let the driller test the water, if you can understand, as a part of a settlement of a case that the EPA brought in 2010 on behalf of homeowners. This is only one of three cases in which the EPA has preliminarily linked water woes to hydraulic fracking. In 2010, the EPA did its own testing in Weatherford And I think you can find a lot of this in Gasland 2, actually. They found dangerous levels of methane. It termed it an imminent and substantial endangerment to homeowners. It issued a notice of violation. It sued Range afterwards. 2 years later, in the run-up, presumably, to the 2012 elections, the agency settled with Range with an agreement that called for Range to conduct four sets of tests of 20 wells in the area. Those independently commissioned tests came back saying there was no methane. Meanwhile, Duke University researchers, it's now disclosed, did their own tests and found combustible levels of methane. I guess the upside is Range Resources probably putting out a PR notice saying, well, at least you don't live in West Virginia.
Well, now those people won't do business with those major chemical processes.
That's
anymore.
Right. Those people who have methane in their water know we're not going to go to that. There you have it, the libertarian solution.
Another large conglomerate.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Tom Philpott.
Don't you want to introduce this?
Well, here's a song by Bruce on Jimmy Fallon last night.
Governor, let me in. I want to be your friend. There'll be no partisan divisions. Let me wrap my legs round your mighty rims and relieve your stressful condition. We got Wall Street masters stuck cheek to cheek with blue-collar truckers, and man, I really gotta take a leak. But I can't, I'm stuck in Governor Chris Christie's four-lane New Jersey traffic jam.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. And somewhere Chris Christie is sitting in his big governor's chair and weeping at the loss of respect from Bruce Springsteen. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Tom Philpott. He is the food and ag correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. Tom, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So about a week ago, I guess it was, maybe it was earlier, I've lost complete track of time, but there was a piece in the New York Times talking about a Hawaiian lawmaker, or I should say a council member, who was trying to follow up on the implications of GMOs. And it highlighted the notion that on the left and perhaps in other circles, there's a tremendous amount of skepticism of GMOs, some of which, or at least part of which, is unfounded in terms of the science. Let's start with just tell us what GMOs are.
Okay. Well, in traditional plant breeding, what people have been doing since the rise of agriculture 10,000 years ago is selecting certain, let's think about maybe apples. You select certain apples that fall from the tree that have particular traits that you like, and you save those seeds and plant them again. And through that sort of long and slow process, you develop varieties. We do this, say, with tomatoes, probably a better example, because they don't come from trees. And the technology stayed pretty static. There were there were some innovations over the years to speed the process up. But basically, if you were working with tomato plants, then you were staying in the tomato genome. You did not move genes across in different species. What GMOs allows plant breeders to do is take genes from other organisms that maybe are going to give the target organism a desired trait, a trait that wouldn't otherwise be there. And so you're splicing this gene into this other genome and creating a new trait. And that's basically what it is. And there's two things that go on there, or two ways to think about it. One is that it is simply a continuation of traditional plant breeding with this new tool, and it's not really very, very different at all. And that is the industry's take on the one hand. On the other hand, though, they also, and this is where the contradiction comes in, they also claim that by doing that, they're creating novel products that need patent protection. And if there's a novel product that needs patent protection, then something is going on that's different than before. So I think the industry has got a contradiction built into its position there.
All right, yeah, and I want to get to that aspect of it in a bit. But essentially, we have this technology that was started, I believe, in the 70s. And this technology is, as you say, taking the genes essentially from across species, and and this is where the argument against GMOs or the skepticism of GMOs becomes nuanced. There are some who contend that eating the genetically modified plants that have been modified on this gene level across species is unhealthy. There's no science that supports that thesis, is there?
Right, and I think the thing with that is that I think people generally acknowledge that when you do this process, you do create novel proteins, and there's a potential for these novel proteins to act in a way that is new and different and potentially harmful. And the scientists that who I know that are not on the lunatic fringe, but that have sort of a skepticism of the GMOs, what they say is that it really has to be on a case-by-case basis, that you can't say that all GMOs are unhealthy and are causing problems, but nor can you say that all GMOs de facto are safe and aren't going to cause problems. And you need to do it on a case-by-case basis. And right now, there aren't a lot of long-term, multi-generational seeding studies that look at particular crops. And, you would have to do, every variety of, let's say, Roundup Ready corn that comes out, or because they have different genetic events that trigger them, and study that. And when we have studied that, it's true that, there's no obvious huge problem with any GMO that's on the market now. And so it's true that when you hear people say stuff like GMOs cause cancer, GMOs trigger allergies, there is little or no evidence to back that up with existing GMOs on the market.
Okay, so once we've established that, and I think we should also say that my understanding is that even when you do cross-species modification, there's still also the chance of those proteins, of potentially toxic proteins, I guess, to be developed in those organisms. That's my understanding. But let's leave that.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And it's okay. So let's leave that aside, because the area in which I think it becomes problematic is what you mentioned earlier, was that it has changed the nature of food into a patentable commodity. And that's one aspect of the implications of this new technology, new, I guess, 40 years in this argument. So flesh that out for us. The idea that these corporations now say, well, we're doing something substantially different enough so that we can basically own all of it.
Right. And so they have won through the political system and various court cases very strong patent rights. And, you know, here's one nuance of the debate that doesn't get stated very often, and that is that the technology has been way overhyped in that it hasn't succeeded. So it's been, you know, you're right, the first sort of successes at it started in the 70s, and it wasn't commercialized until the mid-90s, when you start to get genetically modified corn and soy and cotton to the market in, let's say, 1995 or 1996. And then it grows very rapidly from there in those commodities. But to, you know, almost 20 years into commercialization, you know, 40 some odd years into the technology's existence, the industry has only been able to put on the market in a really big way two traits. It's only been able to achieve two major traits in a commercial way, and those are herbicide resistance. That's a big one. That's the biggest one, and that is where crops are engineered to withstand particular herbicides. And the other one is called BT, basically BT corn and cotton. And BT is a naturally occurring pesticide that has, you know, it's a naturally occurring bacterial pesticide that the scientists have isolated the toxic gene to bugs and spliced into corn and cotton, so those plants express that toxic trait and kill insects. And those are the only two traits that have come to market. And one big reason is that the technology is less precise than it's touted to be. And also because, you know, until the late 90s, until the mapping of the human genome, there was basically a one gene, one trait theory out there. When they mapped the human genome, they found far fewer genes in the human genome than they expected to. And the upshot of it is that genes interact in complex ways that are little understood. And it's really hard to engineer a trait like, let's say, the way that a plant takes up water and making that process more efficient, the way that a plant uses water, is a system that's evolved over millions of years, and it's very complex the way those genes interact. And there's no one gene to pull out of, say, a cactus plant and stick it in corn and make corn drought tolerant. And so the industry has not been able to achieve these complex traits. And so basically what we get on the market is more and more herbicide resistant traits. And that's kind of where we are right now with it. And I think what the industry did was, when they started to realize that, what these companies like Monsanto and Dow and DuPont started to do was, they started to buy up seed companies. So they started to say, the first business model was, okay, let's be like software companies, and we will sell some seeds, mainly the genome, to other seed companies, and they will license these traits from us. And when they realized that they weren't going to have a bunch of blockbuster seeds coming out, they said, let's just sew up the seed company, the seed business itself. And so what you start seeing, starting in the early 2000s, is Monsanto and DuPont and these companies buying up smaller seed companies, and now they dominate basically the global seed market, especially in you know, the big commodity crops like corn and soybeans, but also increasingly in vegetables. And so what they're doing is, we're in a position now where these companies basically own the global seed market, and that in itself is something. I mean, this is market concentration at the extreme level over something that's very vital to our day-to-day existence, and it's something that we should be concerned about, I think.
All right, we'll work our way more to the implications of that, but I want to go back, because this is important, because we were sold the notion of the value of GMOs. I mean, if we've established that any type of like immediate health risks from GMOs are at the very least unsubstantiated by the science. We were also sold,
right, and they're probably unlikely.
Right. Okay. So stipulated. The benefits that we were told was that this stuff was going to feed populations. It was going to provide extra nutrition. It was going to provide crops where no crops could heretofore exist. We're going to be able to, and I guess the third sort of like proposition was, we're going to be able to use less herbicides and pesticides, right, on these things. So reserve the third of those sort of promises. But in terms of the first two, in terms of like golden rice, which it was supposed to be far more nutritious, and or the idea that we were going to have crops that, you know, could grow in barren lands, those two promises simply have not occurred from this technology, have they?
Right. And so the problem is often that when you achieve the desired trait, other undesirable things happen with the plant. Like maybe, you know, you achieve something like increased ability to withstand drought, but then suddenly the plant is susceptible to some, you know, commonly existing pathogen in the environment that the normal crop is not susceptible to. So it's this constant, you know, the finger in the dike idea that these breeders are up against. And yeah, for that reason, these promises, you know, we're still hearing about the genius of golden rice, and you know that the basic narrative of it is that sort of left-wing anti-science zealots have blocked it. But what you don't hear about is how it's still in development. We've been hearing about golden rice since the 90s. That kind of controversy erupted, you know, probably in the late 90s. And, you know, it still hasn't reached the level of commercialization. And it's for those reasons that I'm talking about, that when you increase the vitamin A content of it, that you're doing other things to the plant that are undesirable. And it's also true of drought tolerance. In 2012, Monsanto did release and get approval for a drought tolerant corn. So it's like this major news, big step forward for the industry. But the reason why you haven't heard about it and it hasn't made a splash is that drought tolerant corn, according to the USDA and its approval of it, and it was citing Monsanto documents, didn't perform any better than existing drought-tolerant corns on the market that had been developed through conventional breeding. And it turns out conventional breeding, especially with new technology, but without going across genomes, is actually really effective, a lot more effective than it's given credit for, and a lot cheaper than GMO technology. And you know, you can go to a place where corn has been grown for a long time in arid areas, and that seed stock becomes a great resource for developing drought-tolerant corn. The corn genome itself has those traits in it. And so, yeah, you're right. Those promises have not been met, and they're always dangling in the future. We're going to get this great golden rice. We're going to get, nitrogen-efficient corn and things like that, and it just hasn't happened yet.
And we should say,
I'm skeptical that it ever happens.
And to be fair, though, that pre-existing drought tolerant corn, that's just simply not as profitable. I mean, you can't
right? Yeah,
you can't corner the market on that.
And there's no technology fee built into it. So you get when you have a GMO trait, you charge a technology fee for it, and you get this really exclusive contract, and you don't get that with a non-GMO trait.
So let's go to that sort of that third category of the herbicide resistant, and like you say, there's the herbicide resistant corn, let's say, and then there's the BT corn or BT potatoes or BT soy, which emits its own insecticide. And it seems to me there are less issues in terms of the broader implications of our food supply and our environment with the BT products than there are with this herbicide-resistant corn, because the herbicide-resistant corn ends up not doing what it's supposedly supposed to do, which is to diminish the use of dangerous herbicides.
That's right. But there is a problem with the BT corn specifically, and also in some cases BT cotton, and that is that the way that it's used is that, you know, you get these large swaths of land, you know, tens of millions of acres of land planted in the same variety of BT corn. Now there are, with BT corn, there are these refuge zones. So if you, because, you know, the idea is that there are certain insects that will develop resistance, or there are certain insects, there's a bug called the Western corn borer that is very attuned to growing resistance. And so when the USDA approved BT corn, it made farmers agree to plant a buffer where they plant non-BT corn close by, to ensure that there's this refuge where there's corn borers that are growing that aren't developing resistance to BT. But there was a major controversy when it passed the USDA, and most scientists who looked at it thought the refuge should be much larger than it was. And Monsanto lobbied, and I don't have the numbers up in my hands, but they lobbied to get this sort of tiny refuge built into the law. And predictably enough, in the Midwest, you're getting resistant Western corn borers coming up. And farmers are responding just like they do to the failure of Roundup Ready crops, and that is that they're spraying more and more pesticides. And this is rippling through the Midwest, and most people I talk to, including soil scientists and insect scientists in the Midwest at land-grant universities, say that this problem is probably going to spin out of control, and you're going to get a situation analogous to what happened with herbicides. And so I think the main thing that GMOs have done in the United States since they've come online is that they've intensified industrial agriculture. They've allowed farmers to ramp up monocrops, to plant, you know, more and more of the same thing, because it's easier to manage insects if, you know, the plant itself is expressing an insecticide, and it's easy to manage weeds, at least for a while, if you can douse them with herbicides anytime you want. And so it's allowed this ramping up and intensification of industrial agriculture. And, you know, I feel like we're on this, what ecologists call a pesticide treadmill, in the Midwest. And, you know, it's interesting, in the same period that BT corn took over the Midwest, and so you think, well, that must mean that less insecticides are going to be used. At the same time, the practice of treating seeds with neonicotinoid pesticides also exploded in the Midwest. So it's this extra pesticide that they literally treat the seed with, and the seed is planted, and the corn plant express, and this is also in soybeans too, these plants not only express, like the corn plant not only expresses the BT toxin, but it also expresses this neonicotinoid. It gets into the pollen, into the nectar, into the leaves of the plant. And there's a lot of evidence that this practice, which is ubiquitous, is contributing to the declining health of honeybees and the phenomenon of colony collapse disorder.
Yeah, and so you know,
even the pesticide thing has not been the boom that it's cracked up to be.
I mean, is there hard data that shows that in or not as to whether or not actually the use of this stuff? I mean, okay, so Roundup can now be used, but we've got now super weeds that are developing a resistance to Roundup, which then calls for the use of 2,4-D, right? Is that what it is?
Right. That's what it's called. Yeah.
Tell us what 2,4-D is, because I mean, this is the dynamic that is really problematic here. Is that we're playing whack-a-mole, and the idea was that we were going to get rid of the moles, but all that seems to be happening is we're actually getting more moles, of a more virulent species of moles, as it were. I mean,
that's right.
All right. So yeah, tell us what
that's right. So
2,4-D is.
Well, 2,4-D is a pretty bad herbicide. It's an herbicide that is associated with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and other cancers, and was in the process, you know, basically one of the triumphs of Roundup Ready. Roundup is a Monsanto herbicide that is used ubiquitously on corn and soy. Roundup Ready corn and soy was supposed to lead to the phasing out of older, harsher chemicals like 2,4-D. And in fact, it did. If you look at the use rates, and I've got this in a recent blog post, the use rates of 2,4-D declined sharply in the first 10 or 12 years of the reign of Roundup Ready. But then as weeds develop resistance to Roundup, you see that there's a trough, and then 2,4-D use comes back with a vengeance, and it's now higher than it was before Roundup Ready was rolled out in 1995 and 1996. And so you're getting this this phenomenon of farmers are reverting to these older, more toxic herbicides. And the problem is that once you have in place a bunch of weeds that are already resistant to Roundup, and you start dosing them with 2,4-D, you're going to create weeds that are resistant to both herbicides, and that's happening now. And the industry's solution to this problem, as I wrote about, is to roll out crops that are resistant to both herbicides. And so farmers will not only be spraying 2,4-D before the crop emerges in the spring, but they'll be spraying it all year round. And these, weed scientists at Penn State put a study out saying that it's a virtual certainty that you're going to get 2,4-D and Roundup resistant crops, weeds, and another upward spike in herbicide use in the Midwest. And it's important to note that the same companies that sell these seeds and make billions of dollars in profit from it also sell the herbicides. Dow is a major producer of 2,4-D, is pushing this 2,4-D crop. Monsanto is the major producer, but not the only one anymore, but it's the major producer of Roundup, and it owns the Roundup Ready seed technology. And so these companies make money two different ways, selling the herbicides and the seeds. And, it's kind of jaw-dropping that they benefit from the failure of their products. Because when their products start to fail, farmers still use them, but they just ramp up their herbicide use. And the reason why they still use them is market power. There isn't very much high-quality seeds. These companies have the seed market sewn up, and there isn't very much high-quality seed that doesn't have these traits built in.
So we have a sort of a giant self-licking ice cream cone where these companies that now dominate the market and have squeezed out more and more, progressively squeezed out any alternatives to their seeds, they just keep moving forward. Is there any benefit? I mean, at this point, I mean, if we see this cycle continue, because we haven't even touched upon the implications of, okay, now, it may be one thing that the corn can withstand being bathed in Roundup. They're going to develop a corn that can be bathed in 2,4-D, but presumably this stuff goes somewhere, right? And so we have the problem on one hand of creating a monoculture. We have the problem of less diversity in terms of the seed stock. We have a problem that they need to develop more and more and use more and more pesticides and herbicides. Where do we see any offsetting benefit. Because we should make it clear, these are policy choices. To patent this stuff is a policy choice. To allow this level of market dominance is a policy choice. None of this stuff happens in a vacuum.
That's right. And there's one more policy choice that that should be mentioned, and that is that the incentives in place from farm policy, and this is, you know, basically the farm bill, and we're talking crop subsidies and also subsidized insurance. These incentives offer farmers, they just give farmers no incentive to do something different. And so you could use policy to say that, okay, instead that we will pay that instead of paying you for how much corn you produce, or ensuring that if you have a crop, that if you move into marginal lands that you shouldn't be growing on in the first place and you have a crop failure, you're going to get full compensation for it from subsidized insurance, so you might as well do it. That's how it works right now. So we took that money and said, okay, we're going to pay you based on the number of crops you rotate into your system. So right now you're doing either corn and soy or just corn in some cases. There's a lot of corn on corn going on. We're going to pay you to add a third crop, like wheat or oats or something like that. And it turns out that just by doing that, just by adding a third crop to the rotation, you greatly disrupt both insect and weed patterns, and you need less insecticides and herbicides, and also you need less fertilizer. So it would have all these positive knock-on effects. Or we'll pay you to plant cover crops in the fall and roll them down in the spring, and then plant your crop into this sort of dead thatch of the cover crop, and the cover crop blocks out weeds. And so you get this, you know, basically herbicide free system, and we're going to pay, and it's a risk. It's a new farming style. So we're going to pay you to do that, to put some of the risk on the public. And that would greatly reduce, herbicide use. All of these things could happen. They would be smart policies and they would work, but they would, very much challenge the power of these, you know, these big companies that sell GMO seeds and herbicides.
I mean, let's talk about
it. It isn't like they're.
All right, go ahead. Well, I mean, continue that thought. It isn't like they're.
Yeah, I think I was going to say it isn't like we don't have solutions to these problems. It isn't like we don't know how to reduce herbicides. We don't know how to get away from herbicide resistant superweeds. We know how to do that, and it's pretty simple. But there's just no incentives in place to change.
So, I mean, when we talk about Monsanto, I mean, can the, if this is the dynamic, and this, you know, and frankly, this has been a bit of a debate on this program that I have had with some of our listeners. I mean, can we divorce the concept? I mean, obviously, in a very technical sense, we can. But in terms of the implications of public policy and the implications for our food supply and going forward, can we really divorce GMOs as we know them now from the structure in which they exist and the incentive structure and the corporate dominance? I mean, you know, when we talk about the issue of GMO labeling, you know, which would add at least some measure of transparency, if not to what you're eating, if not only to what you're eating, but more towards the how it actually gets on your plate, and how much involvement there is in our own sort of policy decisions that bring it there. I mean, can we really divorce those two things?
Yeah, I mean, I think theoretically we could. I mean, I think we could revive and reinvest in public seed breeding, which, you know, I think has been an incredibly useful public investment, you know, since the 19th century and more 20th century, in the public universities, public land grant universities doing seed breeding. For the broad public to use without patents, and we could re- and that's it still goes on, but it's been defunded in most
most seed breeding is now private, we could reinvest in it, and there could be intellectual property structure. Like, you know, we could do public GMO breeding that solves, that looks to solve actual problems and not move more pesticides. And there are, you know, there are, I think at the margin, there are things that, that GMOs could probably help with. It would take a substantial investment because it's a very, very expensive technology, and it could quickly crowd out conventional breeding, which is a lot cheaper, and in for a lot of things, a lot of basic things, a lot more cost-effective and cheap. But we could do that. We could say, okay, for certain projects, like there's this problem of citrus greening happening in citrus groves all throughout the world, but also in Florida and Texas and California, where we have citrus. It's this this pathogen that's attacking citrus plants, and it could wipe out the entire industry. And it looks like, and I dug into this, it looks like the most promising solution to it is GM. And right now, the industry itself, the citrus industry, is, you know, kind of making the investment and exploring it, and it's still years away, and it's difficult and hard, and it's no silver bullet. But for stuff like that, for things that, these problems that emerge that really look insoluble, sometimes there is a GMO solution. We could have it on the table like that. It's just not how it works right now.
So, from your perspective, if I was to put you in charge of having one major policy shift that would begin to sort of alleviate the problems that are occurring because of the way that we have commodified these seeds, what would it be? Would it be the patents? Some type of patent reform? Would it be that seed bank that you just mentioned? What would it be?
Well, all of those would be tempting, especially the patent reform. But I think what I would probably do would be to rejigger farm policy to, you know, the basic idea being green payments for farmers. Pay farmers to do things that we have research showing are effective and that work and that create a robust, diverse food supply without a lot of inputs, and incentivize those things, make those things. And, you know, because people complain about farm subsidies, but farming is an incredibly risky venture. And especially now, farmers are so highly capitalized, and they're under huge debts, and it's hard to get them to switch practices. And I think society needs to share some of that risk. But so I think paying farmers to do things, to do things like plant cover crops and broaden their crop rotations would be incredibly effective, and just sort of make Monsanto irrelevant.
Well, of course, we all know that that would be the first step towards totalitarianism and would ruin all of our freedom. So
that's right.
Tom Philpott, thank you so much for talking to us about this today. It's fascinating stuff, and the urgency of this problem is becoming greater and greater. So I appreciate your talking with us to us about it today.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, we got to take a break and head into the funner half of the program, wherein we will probably not get to the Frank Luntz story, but we do have...
That has to just become its own thing.
I know.
That would be like in 2017. And Frank Luntz story.
Right, exactly.
Still not feeling so good about himself. Might get to that later.
We do have some sound, of course, from Stuart Vonnie, who once again shows just what a sociopath he is. And it's specifically around the question of leaving 1.4 million long-term unemployed without any resources. The number of children who are affected by this is also just heartbreaking. It is such an enormous failure that I think it's by our government, but specifically, it just shows. I mean, just an unbelievable. I don't even know how to express this. I mean, the Republicans to filibuster this. I mean, the fact that it couldn't even pass the Senate is stunning. It really is stunning. We will talk about that in the better half. We'll also give you an update on that the TPP stuff. Also the budget as well. We got plenty of stuff to talk about. The number 646-257-3920. We need your support to produce this program on a daily basis. As a way of saying thank you, we give you an extra 50 minutes of programming a day when you become a member at majority.fm. You can also support this program by going to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Use that to buy all your crap that you buy through Amazon. If you buy crap through Amazon, you will notice no difference. We will get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Seeing a little bit of uptick, even more people now getting more of that awesome coffee. It's a great company, so I don't know why you wouldn't do it. If you buy whole bean coffee, I think they sell ground, but I don't know. I'm a whole bean type of guy. I think people know that about me. I don't think I'm telling any secrets out of school. But if you buy whole bean coffee, why would you not buy it from JustCoffee.coop? They'll ship it right to your house or your apartment. They will. It is. Prices are consistent with anywhere else you buy whole bean coffee. You get a coupon code 10% off using Majority. And it's a great company, and it's all fair trade. And if you want organic, they got organic. You want the Majority Report blend, they got the Majority Report blend. Leave us a review on iTunes. We're doing an update to the app. We're going to be updating the iOS app shortly, and then we'll follow it up with the Android. We're taking care of some of the streaming difficulties and some other little bugs. We're not doing any major feature upgrades, but people love this app. We have now nearly 4,000 people listening via the app, or who have downloaded the app, I should say. It's still a fraction of our audience, so I know there's a lot of people out there who don't have the app. It's also the best way to spread the show around to your friends and family. And also, you can go in, you know, somebody was mentioning the other day in the Better Half that they're going into stores.
I wonder who that somebody in the Better Half was.
Well, it wasn't. It was you, but somebody else mentioned it. People are going into stores, like you go into the Apple store, you go into, like, whatever. T-Mobile, just go on to all the devices, whether it's iOS or Android, download the Majority app, put it on the front page.
Yeah, leave it open for people so when they go into the store, they play with the phone, the first thing they see is Majority Report, and they're like, what's this?
Are all the apps so coolly designed and functional? Wow, this is great. All right, folks, see you in the Better Half. You can IM me at Majority FM, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Somebody just IM'd me that the WTF blend at Just Coffee is sadly bitter. Majority FM blend. Peppy and upbeat. Happy. Puts a spring in your step.
Robust and progressive.
Yeah, oh, that's good too. With a hint of irreverence, I believe. All right, we'll see you in the funner half.